Welcome to Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast, the podcast that pulls back the curtain on the evolving world of sports science. I'm Andrew Rizza, an athlete trainer with decades of experience in professional, collegiate, and high school sports.
And I'm Cameron Roth, an orthopedic surgeon and a consultant for the Chicago White Sox.
In each episode, we'll explore the real-world challenges and opportunities facing today's human performance professionals.
Our hands-on experience is transforming sports medicine and breaking barriers through innovation and teamwork.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to this week's Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast. This week, I have Dr. Catherine Logan. Catherine is MD, MBA, and she's also a PT. She's a sports medicine orthopedic surgeon specializing in complex knee and shoulder surgery at Colorado Sports Medicine and Orthopedics. I like to say Cosmo because it reminds me of like Seinfeld. Located in Denver, Colorado, as a former physical therapist, and she's a personal trainer, Dr. Logan provides a distinct expertise in sports injury prevention, surgical management, and recovery. In her past life, she was a physical therapist. And actually, Dr. Logan worked with me in Boston, and that's how we met. And we just reconnected as I saw that she and her colleague also have a podcast called the Sports Doc Podcast, correct?
Correct.
Yes. So she's worked at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore as a therapist and then moved into sports medicine focused clinics. And then she became an orthopedic surgeon. So Dr. Logan, welcome.
Thank you. I'm excited, Riz.
This will be great. And it's great that we're able to do this because I get all excited when I start to see people that I haven't seen in a while and talk about things that we're all in like-minded about. And we can get this information out to the people that are around us. And I think it's awesome. So
yeah, thank you for having me. I'm very honored.
So being in Colorado and you are really focused in on the skiing population out there, I figured what better than to talk about ACL injuries and then even some other stuff like medial collateral, ligament or MCLs and meniscal tears and patella dislocations and chondral defects and all the fun stuff. So I figured we'd just chat about some of that stuff and get some information out to our listeners. So can you give us a little maybe more history about yourself than what I've already done?
Yeah. For sure. So, you know, as you talked about, I was a PT first. So my intention was never to be a surgeon or a doctor. It wasn't like on my radar at all. My sister had torn her ACL 3 times when we were growing up. So like high school and that first year of college for her. So she was a college athlete. So since she was my older sister, she was my ride everywhere. I was always at her PT clinics, you know, and just like watching her do her PT. So that was really my first like, oh, this is interesting. And I like sports medicine. So right out of college, went into PT and just thought that's what I was going to do. And then probably was like my second or third year in practice. So like right when I was in that Hopkins area, I was at a practice that we shared with surgeons. So, you know, your break room and like where you had lunch, it was with surgeons. And I just found myself like, oh, what are you doing? And, you know, just really interested in their job. So by the time you and I were working together, I don't know if you remember this, I was already taking my like prereqs at the Harvard program. So I was working like 3 really long days. And then I would go to school on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Like I would take the train to Cambridge and, you know, do my orgo and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah. So it was quite interesting. I remember this. And I think I probably looked at you one day. I'm like, what are you doing?
Yeah. I think a lot of people did. So did my husband.
They're like, yeah, I'm going to go back to medical school. I'm like, okay, like, let me know how it goes.
Yeah, good luck.
And here we are. So if I'm ever out in Colorado, I'm definitely going to look you up. I'm a big skier. As you can see, my sign behind me, my Sugarloaf sign, that's where we ski up here in Massachusetts. But honestly, I'm a huge skier. I've never skied out west. So my wife won't go like west in a plane to go skiing. I got to kind of con her into like, you can go shopping or do whatever. Just let me go skiing.
Yeah. No, I think it's a totally different experience as far as like, especially if you do the spring skiing, like the weather is so nice. Like half the time, you know, it's midday and you're taking your jacket off and you're sitting outside and it feels like you're getting a sunburn.
Yeah, it's great. Do you leave a stack of business cards like at Après Ski, like on the corner of a table?
It is. I mean, it's pretty crazy, like how much, you know, it's just, we were sharing before we, you know, hit record when we were just sort of catching up on our own that Monday morning or like Mondays, basically I learned my first few years in practice, like not to even fill my schedule. So we just leave some afternoon appointments open. Anna, who works and runs my schedule, she won't even fill them because Monday morning after a weekend, it just like the phone is ding, 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 ding. And, you know, it's just a lot of ski trauma.
Yeah. And it's one of those things we see it, you know, in Massachusetts and where we are because we have a big ski community. But, you know, we end up seeing is a lot of the ACLs are, you know, that I've had people in the lift line get knocked over or get caught on a gate or, you know, something simple. And it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And I say to them, listen, when I ski 8 o'clock to one, I'm off the mountain. I'm gone. I don't even go near it. Like, and that's where we're seeing a lot of those injuries. So since we're talking about ACLs, can you give the listeners a little bit more information on, they always ask the question, do I have an autograft, an allograft? Do I use a hamstring, patella tendon, quad tendon? What are kind of the things that make you make that decision as a surgeon? Is it by age? Is it gender? Is it what they're going to get back into? Maybe you can kind of talk about all those things.
For sure. So as far as the graft discussion, I do, you know, factor in age and I do factor in gender or sex. So as far as age, you know, that you'll see some studies that sort of the difference between allograft and autograft outcomes and re-tear rate, you know, somewhere between 35 and 40, it becomes all the same. You know, as far as if you're a 40-year-old person and you get an allograft versus using an autograft, you know, I think it really all comes out in the wash as far as, you know, the re-tear rate. Some people will say 35. I just sort of use that general, probably 40 is kind of my mark. But if someone's 38 and they feel really strongly they want a cadaver, I really don't have a great medical argument to say like, no, you better do autograft. That said, you know, Colorado people, they're super healthy. I have some 50-year-olds who are like black diamond, like backcountry, and they'll say, I'm using my own tissue. I know I have great tissue. I give them that data. Ultimately, I let them decide. But if it was like a 22-year-old kid and they said, I want a cadaver, I'd be like, I'm not your girl. Like, you got to go to another surgeon.
I'll give you to a colleague.
Yeah. Then as far as hamstring, quad, you know, BTB, I think you probably see a lot of regional differences. And I don't know where Massachusetts is falling these days. But when I was in residency in Boston, it was really very split between hamstring and patella tendon. And then you would see quad a lot at Children's. Whereas like out here, you see a lot of quad and you see a lot of patella tendon. You really don't see the hamstring as much. I personally don't love the hamstring because I think the data especially isn't as good for women. And the re-tear rate is a little higher in our female patients. So, you know, I don't like to, you know, we're seeing a lot of female patients out here. It's about 5 to 1 female to male. So hamstring is just kind of fallen out of my repertoire unless, which you do see out here, the people who've already torn the BTB and who've already torn, you know, it's like third surgery type thing.
Yeah. Okay.
So then we're, you know, we're left with the BTB and the quad. And I think the argument for both is strong as far as what do you care most about? And that's re-tear rate. And I really think, you know, one study is going to say this, one study is going to say that. But at the end of the day, I think they're pretty equivalent for re-tear rate. Then we're starting to think about what are the pros and cons. And it really is like the rehab side. And it's like, that's where my PT brain is sort of like, all right, here's the things that kind of bug you about a BTB. Here's the things that bug you about the quad. And you know this, like they get a lot of anterior knee pain after the patella tendon. Most of people, it goes away.
Yeah.
Not everybody, but most people. The quad, they'll get, you know, some quad soreness, some quad tightness, especially as they really start to hypertrophy the quad. But usually goes away in everybody.
Yeah. Now, do you have the conversation with the person that might be, you know, a tradesman that's kneels a lot? Do you sway them away from BTB because of the kneeling? Or does it just depend?
Yeah, I do. And, you know, I think ultimately they're both really good grafts. And I sort of say, hey, this is something that's probably going to bug you, you know, or someone who's super into yoga. You know, I think that's another person who's just kneeling a ton.
Yeah.
I think like it can just be a little bit annoying. Like, and the way I sort of phrase it as, what do you really care about? You care that, is this going to happen again? And I think between the quad and the BTB, your risk level is the same, but the patella tendon might just drive you a little nutty.
Yeah. And how are you guys with your protocols for reconstructive procedures? Are you, do you have a go-to group that's with you guys or is it an outsource for PT? Did you help, you know, write the being a PT, did you help write those protocols? And
yeah, so I write the protocols, which I guess you're probably not surprised because it's like, and we do a couple different things. So obviously it's really important that people go to a PT that's convenient for them, that they're going to be. So one of the first things I did when I moved to Denver was just visit so many PT places. So I probably visited about like 50 places when I first got here just to sort of try and see. Because sometimes like you go to a clinic and it's really great, but maybe they're better at back pain. you know, and then another clinic is really, you know, great at sports med, and another place is better at geriatric, right? So I just try and match them with a place that I know is going to do a great job as far as sports medicine and has the right equipment, has the right attention to detail, feels really comfortable with post-op. And then in my clinic, I basically have a physical therapist in my orthopedic clinic, my clinic days, and that person does a lot of the exercise testing. So we have, like, within the clinic, we have like force plates, biomotion camera, and isometric strength testing. So we use Bald. I don't know if you know that company, but
yeah, I actually had just finished a master's 2 years ago in applied sports science analytics. So we used a lot of that stuff. So yeah, it's great stuff.
And I think we use our equipment we probably do at least 5 or 6 rounds of tests a day. So we definitely, it's not like once a month, it's like, let's get the cobwebs off. So one of the reasons why we do that, one is like, you know, I think the OCD sort of PT side of me is like, I got to make sure that they get a good outcome. And as we know, not all PT is created equal. So it's like, you know, they might go to your clinic in Wellesley and we're really happy, right? And then somebody lives really far away and they're like more in a rural area and they're going to a PT clinic that's not used to seeing ACLs. So part of having the PTs in clinic is they're not their primary PT, but they do the testing. You know, you might have someone who's doing great and they're sailing through, and then you might have someone else who's maybe a little behind. And that PT, they get a full hour with them during that appointment. So they can sort of say, okay, let's add these exercises to your program, or they can dry needle, or they can stretch, or they can do some manual therapy and kind of get them refocused or back on track.
Yeah, I think that's fantastic, because it we'd like to get more of that out here in Boston where that's there. I know Children's has the McKaylee Center, which they have that availability. That's where Carl is, which is fantastic because he can then see those patients and then refer them out. He just sent me a patient from there that it's her fourth ACL. But she looks amazing. She came out, she's 3 weeks out, terminal knee extension, straight leg raise, can do everything, looks great. Ben Hayworth did her surgery. She looks amazing. And we get some of those, you know, they go in, but they do all the testing there. They have all of the force plate technology and the camera, 3D motion capture. So they have everything there if we need it, which is fantastic.
And you know, the other thing, Riz, is like, they just get more buy-in too, where it's like two things happen. One is like, I feel like, especially in Colorado, people are pretty competitive. We have like a PR board for tests. And people are always like, they get like a metric, like their isometric, like the force newtons or whatever. And they'll like look over at the board and be like, where am I? You know, like, and it keeps them like motivated. And they know if I'm like, all right, this is where you should be, but at your next visit, here's what I expect. They're sort of like, okay, I can see them taking notes on their phone. Like, I'm going to, you know, get this next thing and I'm going to be on that board. So I like that.
Yeah, it's pretty good stuff. Since we're on this ACL talk, I guess the Pandora's box is the meniscus, right?
Yes.
Like, what do we do with the meniscus? So if you have someone that comes in with ACL, medial meniscal tear, what's the conversation at that point? Like, I guess, you know, you have to see what type of tear it is, where it is, how involved it is. Do you tend to, when do you talk fixing versus not? Like, sutures versus not?
I would say I'm always hoping to fix and preserve, right? But we can't always do that. So if it is, say, you know, we think about that anatomy, if it's like in that white where there's really like no blood supply, it's really like internal sort of interior tear, you know, we're probably going to clean up. But as they start to get more into the periphery, even if they're complex tears and it's not, you know, one sort of simple longitudinal or vertical tear, I have that conversation of the goal is to really preserve as much as possible. The risk of preserving is sometimes down the line, some of it fails, but usually not all of it. And you need a little cleanup or something like that. But from my perspective, it's always better to take that risk and try and preserve the tissue, knowing that down the line, yeah, maybe we need to touch it up and clean it up. And that's not the end of the world. But taking it out, especially like I just did a meniscus transplant on a 25-year-old. Because when she's 16, somebody just took it out.
Right.
You know, and it didn't even try and preserve it. And it's sort of, that's a terrible thing to be, you know, faced with at such a young age.
Yeah. I mean, I've talked to a bunch of surgeons out here. I'm sure, you know, Tom Gill I work with and the group Mass General and Children's. And one of the things we talk about is, you know, they're in the business of preservation and they talk about that. And that's the one thing I learned years and years and years ago, you know, speaking with Carl and all of the other therapists that you and I had worked with and surgeons we work with. And you have to look at, I tell patients this all the time, like if you have a meniscal tear that they can salvage and sew and preserve, you're better off preserving it, because down the road, you don't want, the less you have, it's you're going down the route of transplant or total knee if you have so much degenerative change in your knee. Because you had that ACL tear, then, hey, why don't we try to fix it now and see if we can get as much as we can out of it? That's a good conversation to have with them. So I think it puts them at ease when they hear it from us as well, because they think the surgeon just wants to do surgery.
Yeah, totally.
It's like, no, they want to make your knee better. They don't want to see you again, maybe down the road, but yeah, they want to make you better. They want you to have a good outcome.
Agree.
When you look at that person that comes in, there's been always this discussion on, you know, MCL tears, do we fix them? Do we not do anything with them? I really haven't seen any. I think I've had, quite honestly, in 30 years, I may have seen two, you know, and those are usually, you know, avulsions where they have to tack it back down again. And is that mostly what you guys see?
Yes. So if I'm going to fix, it's generally a distal avulsion because they're just not going to heal well. We have to put those back down. But I will say my experience in Colorado is a little different than in Boston, that sometimes you get these really high velocity ski injuries and they sometimes will get a complete rupture proximally as well. And I actually had one recently where it was a distal avulsion and like a grade 2 proximally. So it was kind of hanging on.
Yeah.
So just that high sort of velocity, what I will do with them is, I'll have to send it to you after, is, so I don't know if you know the name, Dr. Robert LaPrade. He is now at the University of Minnesota, but he was in Vail when I was doing my fellowship. He's done a lot of biomechanical studies on when you do the varus or valgus stress, so whether you're worried about the FCL or LCL. Yeah. Or the MCL, and you're basically doing a side-to-side comparison under x-ray. And then you're looking at how much is that, is there a gap? And you can actually measure it. And then there's numbers that you can rely on and say, hey, this is essentially a non-functional MCL. You should address it. So it's made it very black and white. And so I will, if I can do those in clinic, I will. So you can actually go into the x-ray with the patient and put a stress while you're doing like an AP picture of the knee. And then you make those measurements. But sometimes they're guarding. And it's too painful to do that stress. And really, so if they are too painful, but I'm still worried about, I'll actually do that while they're asleep in the OR and just run the x-ray, the C-arm in. And then you can test that gapping there. And so it either gives you that sort of security of, no, like it actually is pretty symmetric to their other side, or the increment is pretty minimal versus, oh, wow, you know, this is pretty wide. So those studies were really great in that you're not sort of hemming and hawing, going, I wonder if this is one of the ones. Like, yeah. It's very clear.
And if you have an injury that's, just think plain MCL sprain, you know, grade 2, grade 1, grade 2, they're not responding. How does biologics fit into your practice? Like, what do you guys do you use biologics and how does that work with the patient?
I do have biologics. So we do have PRP in the practice. And so if someone is not responding, that's part of the conversation. And I usually actually tell them about it up front, because I'll often, when I'm telling them about the treatment, I'll say all the things that like are, you know, in the armamentarium or like basically in the spectrum, and sort of say, hey, this is the most conservative stuff we're going to start with. You know, this is failing. This is what we can add. And this is what we can add and blah, blah, blah. And so I will mention it from the beginning, but it's certainly not, you know, I think in the NFL, you know, and sometimes they're using it pretty quick, but that's different, right? So it's not paid by insurance. So I just say, this is something that we might consider if all else doesn't work, but most likely the other stuff is going to work.
Yeah, which is good. I think laying it all on the table is perfect. I think they understand that. And we have people in Wellesley that would just go, I'm going to get a PRP injection. Like it's like going to get coffee at Starbucks.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a little different.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure out in like Vail, it's probably different too, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely, we have that similar with like Boulder too. You know, Boulder is a very active endurance athlete population. You know, so you get these ultra marathoners and like cyclists, rock climbers that are doing everything they can do to avoid surgery. So there is like some specialty clinics that's really all they're doing, like biologics. So, you know, sometimes people are like, you know what, if there isn't really a downside besides my pocket, I'll go try it.
Right. Yeah, 100%. Kind of shifting gears a little bit, looking at patellofemoral injuries or patella dislocations. We see them in, you know, high school level. I had an athlete that had one playing baseball a few years back. So MPFL, had a reconstructive surgery. With kids, like, what's your focus with that athlete that maybe had one dislocation?
Yeah.
Is there a discussion right off the bat? Like, hey, this is what the statistics show. This is what the literature shows. Like, let's fix this or let's try PT first. Like, what's your go-to?
I'm always a try PT first with patella dislocations and with shoulder dislocations. But having that sort of discussion, I think there's a couple things that are important. One is, you know, their age. Are they still growing? You know, because if they're still growing, you know, we're perhaps going to see a, you know, even an increase of like the tendency to dislocate the patella. But I also am like sensitive to where are they in their current season. So I felt like at our Wellesley clinic, one of the things I really loved about it is we had such a high adolescent population and we had a lot of people coming from Children's Hospital. And I just loved that population. But as you know, working at high school, like it's devastating to remove somebody from their sort of social network and their athletic like identity. So if someone is like, I had a girl today who's actually, she's a wrestler. And, you know, she's got states coming up. She's got some subluxation, like anterior dislocation of her shoulder. And it's like, can we get through those next couple of weeks so she can get through states versus trying to pull her now? Like, you know, so I think there's always those conversations that are a little bit more subtle and nuanced and letting mom and dad or whomever know that, you know, they have a say in all of this. The kid has a say in all this, like, but trying to protect like their mentally as well.
Yeah. And it goes back to what we talked about pre-recording here. Our friend and colleague that Mark Price, like he was always like, hey, pause for a minute. Let's try rehab. Like that shoulder will be okay. Let's kind of come back to it. And that's that same example. You know, we had talked about this previously, like let's take care of the shoulder the way we should take care of the shoulder. And we can always go back to it. Like, let's not just jump in to do the repair. We can always do it later, right? If there's no indication of further damage that it's going to be, you know, long term. And like that's, we have to be, we talk about athletes all the time, how to keep them mentally in the game, right? And that's, they have so many issues with keeping up with academics, being, you know, applying to schools, the anxiety, the stress, the social life. We do the best we can to keep them involved. And if it's helping the team in another way, if they can't play, like help coach younger kids, like you can sit there and shoot free throws if you have a sprained ankle, like things that they can do to try to keep them involved, I think is important. So it's always good conversations.
I think so too. And I think there's other stuff that like they can learn from the sideline. It's like, so infrequently do they get the opportunity to sort of look at their position or their opponent and truly spend time and think like, oh, like I could actually be incorporating whatever to help me beat this person the next time I play them. Or
yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It's all good stuff. Now, if you have that patient that comes back, so ACL reconstruction, they come back a few years down the road. Oh, no, chondral defect. Like, what's the conversation at that point? Obviously, the size of the chondral defect makes a difference. Where it is makes a difference. When do you look at microfracture versus a MACI or a replacement? Like you said, you just had done a cartilage replacement. You did a meniscal replacement, but not a bone cartilage. When it's bone cartilage related, when do you have those conversations and what it needs to be done?
I would say I similarly present sort of all the options as far as everything is colored by their age and their activity level. And because if you're having someone in who's 25, it's a very easy conversation about, you know, the importance of potentially being a little bit more aggressive about a surgical solution, because we're now thinking about what do you want to be like when you're 45 or 50 versus someone who is already 45 or 50. Now we're like, okay, do we really want to put you through 9 months of cartilage restoration rehab? When maybe it's just about cross training more and maybe getting an unloader brace or trying a little bit of biologic. So I think that colors everything. But I'm a big fan of giving them all the options and weighing the pros and the cons, because I don't think there's one solution for everybody. But as far as if I think someone's going to go down the surgical path for cartilage, I really, you know, I look at the MRI. So say we're talking about condyles. I look at the MRI and it's one thing if it's just cartilage damage, but often underneath it, you're going to see some bone edema. So from my perspective, when you look at something like that, that's a cartilage and a bone problem. And your solution should be a cartilage and a bone like solution. So that would be like an osteochondral allograft, like a plug. Here in Colorado, I would say the defects are usually large. We're very rarely getting the 4 millimeter, you know, 5 millimeter. It's like, you know, I've had some that are 20 or 22, but often sides they're 10 or 12, like from a good old like ski injury. So with those, I don't mess around with microfracture. So I would say it's almost rare in my practice now that microfracture comes into play. So if it is, you know, generally for the condyles, I'm more into the osteochondral allograft because, like I said, there's often some bone edema in there and I want to put in some good bone to help that set in. For the patella, there are people who do osteochondral allograft for the patella. The hard part, as you know, is like the contour of the patella is so tricky.
It's so different, yeah.
It's really hard to match. And there's some people out there that say, oh, no big deal, I can match that. That's where I find MACI is really useful. And so I'm a bigger fan of MACI. And if there is a little bit of a bone issue, you can put some bone graft in there too.
Okay.
But I like MACI for the patella a lot, or any sort of surface like in the trochlear groove. That is really hard to get the matching.
Yeah, so that's a good explanation because I think people don't quite understand like the reasoning behind. I think therapists that are listening or athletic trainers listening, but for the general population, it's like, oh God, I have this quarter size defect in my knee. What do I do with it? Like, okay, these are some of the options that you should be hopefully being able to ask your surgeon. If not, get some answers on what's best for you, because we know down the road it could end up in a cobalt alloy knee.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. For sure.
So in preventing ski injuries, what's the conversation? Do you ever guys ever go out to the ski groups and to local schools and say, hey, this is a program we're going to invest in and this is what we want you guys to do. So you don't need to see us. Like, do you guys have that program out in Colorado?
I would say not me specifically, but a lot of those programs exist through the PT clinics. So for example, there is a local clinic called Evolution. They do something every year that starts in the fall that's called Wintervention. It was a great name, but they basically run these classes that are like, okay, you want to get ready for the mountain. You know, these are like sort of the strengthening exercises that are important to do. There's a lot of focus on hip strength, core strength, and trying to build things so that we can avoid that valgus moment in the knee. And then they do a lot of jumping and they're taught by either strength and conditioning or physical therapists or athletic trainers. So it's always people who are really knowledgeable so that if someone has poor mechanics while they're doing the jumping part of, because they're more like station-based, that can correct them and sort of help them along. But those programs definitely exist and they're very popular.
Yeah. I remember Carl started an ACL prevention program when his daughter was like in seventh or eighth grade with soccer. And he goes, he's so proud of it. He goes, not one girl in 4 years at Medfield High School in soccer tore their ACL when we had that program in place. Like, and that's one of the things. They just did an ACL prevention, which is, I think everybody should be doing regardless of gender. It just, or even just cross train. Like, let's get you in the gym, get you doing what you need to do. So one, you don't need to see us.
Actually, the other thing that you kind of mentioned earlier, but I do talk to patients all the time, especially after, say, I've seen them, they've already had their ACL and now they're graduating, they're like returning back to sport. I always tell them, you got to get off the mountain by 1 p.m. Like, it just like, it all goes. So especially in the big mountains out here, you know, at the end of the day, it's like this, like coming down, it's like people are getting hurt on greens. The light is terrible. It's like this funnel of death.
The flat light's terrible. You have a north facing mountain. Good luck, you know, at the end of the day.
So I'm always out by 1 o'clock. I'm like, see you later.
And I'm an edge of the tree. I'm the edge of the trail skier and I'm in the woods. Like, and that for me, like if I'm not in the center of the trail at all, and if you don't know the terrain, you're in trouble. You know, that's not good. If there's someone listening that has a knee injury, what should they do? Should they be calling your office? Should they be calling their primary care? Should they be going to the emergency department? Like, what's kind of the best order of operation?
So I can't remember. Do you guys have direct access in Massachusetts? You don't. Well, right. You're Joe.
Yeah.
Okay. So we have direct access here for physical therapy as well. So one or two things really happen. Either they call their PT, because a lot of people in Colorado, since they are so active and healthy, they already have a relationship, you know, so they'll be calling that person and saying, what should I do? And they'll either say, come in and I'll check you out, or you know, PTs in Colorado can order imaging. So sometimes they do that. Some of them don't want to, because they don't want to worry about the follow-up of it, which I understand too. So that's where, like in our clinic, you know, when we're worried about an ACL tear, we really try and get them in that same day, because it's honestly psychologically, like it's just torture for them to know, like, you know, have I just sort of done what everybody else in Colorado has already done? Am I, you know, one of the statistics now?
Yeah, right.
So we try our best to at least get them in to get the MRI started so they can kind of at least know what's next.
Yeah. I mean, I know from experience, I mean, we have people that I've had relationships with over the years, I have my cell phone number on my business card and everybody in my office thinks I'm nuts. And I go, no, I like helping people. That's what we do, right? And that's fine. I get it. But they'll send a message like, hey, my brother just hurt his knee. Can you take a peek at him tomorrow? Like, hey, no problem. Have him come to the clinic. I'll take a look and then I can help you get into the doctor. And most of our surgeons, and I'm sure you guys operate like this, have them call give me their phone number. I'll have the admins in the front office call and we'll get them right in. And they can either see the PA or if there's an AT that's on staff that can help or PT, they will get them going. So I think that's the best way to just to provide that next level of care for the patient because we're all in it to do what? Make people better, right? So you got to do it. So PT background, MBA, orthopedist, podcaster. You guys started a new app, which I'd like to hear a little bit about because I want to get that out for you guys. What do you do in your free time? Oh, yeah, you have two kids. They play hockey and you ski. What else do you like to do?
I snowboard because your ACL is better if you snowboard. Honestly, I grew up skiing and then my husband was the same way. He grew up skiing and then his story. So, you know, Stu, he was playing professional hockey. And then when he retired, he basically got a job offer, but it was going to be a couple months away. So they were like, his friend was like living out in Sun Valley, Idaho. And they're like, come out here, work at a ski shop for a couple months and like bum around. So he did that. And when he got there, they're like, do you know how to snowboard? He's like, no. And they're like, well, you need to know both. And that's what this shop demanded, like, so that you could fit and talk to anybody who comes in. So he basically was like, okay, I guess I'll learn. And then, so he can do either. But me, it is really funny. Like if I see 100 ACLs, say a winter, it's like 98 of them are skiers. So
yeah, that's it. You're controlled on the board.
Yeah. But my boys ski. They play hockey and they play lacrosse. So I think the nice thing about Colorado is things are very family friendly. Even if you're going to like a concert or a restaurant, it's like, I don't know, families are sort of always included. So we're just out and about in our community a lot. My husband coaches. So I think it's just a lot of sports, you know, this age, we don't really want to miss anything. You know, they're 11 and 9. They'll be gone before I know it. So
it's quick.
Yeah, it's quick.
But they still call for money.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah.
Can I use the Starbucks card? Well, don't you have money? No. Yeah, you do. Yeah, that they do. And you still give it to them because I get the phone call. My wife doesn't because she'll say no.
Yeah. But it's still like, you know, you're always just running around. Like yesterday, we had a birthday party for one of them. He wanted to do a Skate City, which is like a roller rink. And like, you know, we're there for like 10 minutes. Some kid splits open his like chin and I'm like out in the car, like fixing up his chin and like doing like Dermabond. And I'm like, all right, let's go. You know, so it's always something, you know.
We all have that stuff on our car. They always look to us. Yeah. And an AED, I usually have in mind, but hopefully I never use that. What's a fun fact about you?
Okay. So I would say the fun fact that most people are surprised about. So the summer after college, my best friend growing up, still my best friend, Zan, she's a chef. Her dad was in the Secret Service. And so the summer after college, he was like, girls, do you want a job working the World Cup? So it was in Paris that year. And so he was running, like helping organize all the security for all the Americans. And he was actually living over there for the year, you know, setting up all the security leading up. And so we went over there and we were security guards for an entire summer for like the World Cup. And so like...
Did you have a hat and everything?
I mean, no, I had a walkie and like a yellow jacket. I didn't get an earpiece. But those, you know, it's... People are ravenous, right? Like it's like they're like clawing, trying to like get into events and climb over you and stuff like that. So my fun fact is not so much that I was just the security guard, but I was securing the gate. And there was like a driver that wanted to get through. He didn't have a pass. And usually they would stick another, like a big dude around me because I'm not that big.
Yeah.
And the guy in France, you're allowed to have alcohol at lunch. So he went and had his wine and he was taking a very long lunch and not getting back to like our station. And so I was by myself and this driver's going to get through my French's. And he didn't have the pass. So I was saying no. And then I was trying to act busy because he was clearly mad. And so he was sitting in his car and I kept pretending I was still trying to get the guy to come back over, but because I think he was, you know, having his glass of wine. Anyway, long story short, the guy realizes I'm not actually pressing the button because the red light is not going on. So I had done it initially, but I kind of just wanted to look busy. And so anyway, he gets out of the car and he's like, no button, no button. He's yelling at me in French. And he decked me. He hit me in the face.
Oh my God.
So there was police right there. They ended up arresting him. And I was like, I mean, I was fine. Like, it wasn't that, it was like more the chin. So it was fine. But yeah, it was kind of funny. That's my fun fact.
Interesting.
I didn't tell my parents till I got home. They would have, they would have been pissed.
They would have yanked you, shoot.
We didn't tell Secret Service Bob and we didn't tell my parents. So we got back like 2 months later.
Now, did your friend's father still, is he retired from the Secret Service now?
Yes.
Yeah. Did he ever get presidential duty?
Yeah.
That was awesome.
Secret Service Bob.
That's pretty cool. I did meet a gentleman that was his, I think he was a patient of ours, I believe. And his wife was, his friend was Secret Service. They lived in DC. He was telling me the story. And the wife was pulling out of the house one day and a black SUV drove up and pulled her over. And she's like, oh, crap. Like a guy gets out. He's like, ma'am, did you realize what you just did? And then she rolls the window down and looks at him and it's him. Like she's like completely freaking out, but he would do that once in a while and pull them over. And
yeah. So funny.
Yeah. Talk about misuse of authority, but it's good anyway. Can you give a little brief description of the app that you guys have out?
Oh, for sure. Okay. Yeah. So we've been talking a lot about, you know, ACL and athlete identity and all that sort of stuff. So being therapists and being an athletic trainer, like, you know, like it just, people, when they have that sort of injury, it's not just like the physical recovery. It's like very much the mental, emotional, and, you know, how you're impacted either from being away from your team or fear of re-injury or fear of I'm never going to be as good as I was, you know, all these sort of things. So I always felt like that was a really big gap in how we cared for people after injury. We were just so focused on, no, you got to strengthen, you got to do your range of motion, you know, everything's physical, physical, physical. Or as the surgeon, we're all like, no, I put in a perfect implant. There's nothing else to do, you know? So basically our program, so Emily Perrin, who is a mental health counselor and coach, she basically and I met through USA Lacrosse. So we both have worked with the USA Lacrosse organization and we were taking care of a lot of the same athletes. So I'd be like dealing with the physical side and she'd be dealing with like the mental, emotional. And we basically were like, could start collaborating. We started our company, which is called The Unbroken Athlete. And we did with my patients a pilot program, which is the ACLs. The program is called ACL Unbroken. And we basically gave them access to 12 months of modules that go from, you know, the initial like acclimating to the new normal all the way to, you know, athlete identity to eventually returning to sport and fear of re-injury. And so there's this gentleman, Dr. Albright, who in the pediatric ACL literature published on grit, and you probably know this, but what he sort of found was if people had a low, and the grit scale was created by Angela Duckworth, and so it's a validated scale. He implemented it pre-op with all his ACLs and then assessed it, you know, at different points of recovery. And what he found was that people who had low grit on that scale had a worse physical outcome. Mm-hmm. The other thing he found was just by going through rehab alone, nobody's grit improved. It just sort of stays steady. Yeah. So Emily and I were basically like with the Unbroken Athlete, can we change these grit scores? And then will that change the physical outcome? So we did our pilot program for a year with my patients and we did see an increase in grit. And then we're also seeing really great physical outcomes. Okay. So we wanted to launch it more broadly. So our app launched. So the Unbroken Athlete app, which has a bunch of programs, but that all launched in January of this year. And so you can get the ACL Unbroken app. And there's also, you know, we have different like podcast episodes that are about some of these mental health resilience sort of focus topics and, you know, free resources, blogs, those sort of things are all in the app.
That's great. That's awesome. Because we talk about the mental health piece and how that affects, you know, kids. I mean, just stepping back on the field, no matter what the injury is, right? So can athletes use this if they don't have an ACL? Is there something there just for mental health? Is that another piece of it?
Yeah. So that's actually going to be coming out pretty soon. So there's a little, there's some stuff already on there, like through the podcast and audio links, as well as some of the blog articles. But the program that's going to be for general recovery and not ACL specific is going to be out within the next like 4 to 6 weeks. So that's coming really soon.
Good. So I'll get the link from you. We'll put it in our show notes and then try to put it on the episode, which would be great as a link. We can tap it. I'm learning my technology.
There you go.
Well, listen, Catherine, amazing to catch up with you. Super excited for this talk. It was great. Awesome. Well, Catherine, thanks again.
Thank you.
It was great. I'll let you know when this is ready to rock and roll.
Perfect. Thanks so much for having me, Riz. Good to catch up.
Nice seeing you.
You too.
Thanks for listening to Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast. Follow us on social media, watch full episodes on YouTube, and check out our website.
The information shared on this podcast is for educational and informational purposes only and is not intended as medical advice. Please consult a licensed healthcare provider for guidance related to your specific situation. We'll see you next week.